tonight I am going to talk about greed, anger, and ignorance, grasping, aversion, and certainty. Greed, anger, and ignorance are traditionally presented together, although as we'll see, it was actually anger in specific that prompted me to give this particular talk on this night. I'm having some fairly intensive computer difficulties at work, and so that gave me the opportunity to examine my own practice with regard to some of this. But greed, anger, and ignorance, these things are presented together because they're in Buddhism seen as what's called the three poisons, the three roots of all the suffering that we cause for ourselves. And my practice of Zen, especially my practice of the Zen of lay life, which is the Zen outside of a monastic setting, which is the Zen that includes all of our lives and not just what we do on the cushion. My practice of Zen is continually opening the hand of thought with regard to my own grasping, my own aversion, my own ignorance, paying vigilant attention to seeing the way these things arise in my mind, and using the space that I cultivate in Zazen, the spaciousness that we cultivate in Zazen, to start to have a little bit more of a choice in terms of what I do when grasping and aversion arises, when anger arises. The spaciousness of Zazen also contributes to one's ability to actually see these things arising, which is the first step before having the space to make a choice about what one does. And there is a point in practice that comes and goes, but it's certainly one that everyone will inevitably pass through at least once, which is the point at which you're able to see your own grasping and aversion coming up, and you're seeing it, and you're completely unable to change any of your habitual patterns around it. But that's an excellent place to be, and you can just reflect on your own spiritual progress because you haven't even been there. That's a huge step. Even the step that you're so frustrated with yourself, that your inability to break out of your current habits, your current reactions, that is a wonderful spiritual development. So this for me is the core practice of daily life in Zen. One of them. And this is what we begin our liturgy with. We atone for all the greed, our endless suffering created by greed, anger, and ignorance. And this is the point of beginning our liturgy, point of beginning our practice. One way to look at what we do with Zazen, the reason we do Zazen, is to facilitate it. I want to read it. So I'm going to sprinkle in various quotes into this talk. This first one is from Lama Yeshe, talking about hell. And hell, in the Buddhist sense, isn't a place that one goes to, and it certainly doesn't have anything to do with before or after death. Hell is a state of mind. Hell is precisely when suffering fills our body and mind and there's no space from it. Lama Yeshe says, hell does not exist from its own side. The negative mind makes it up. The mind of grasping and aversion creates it. I am also going to be drawing liberally from this book, Saying Yes to Life, Even the Hard Parts, which I co-authored with Ezra Beda. One of the funny things about this book for me and Ezra is that part of the process of co-authoring it, we both have a book we're very, very happy with, and we both have a book that doesn't feel precisely like our own teaching. It doesn't feel like So, I mean, in a way, it is precisely our teaching. But both of us have a little bit of the experience of reading through it and going, wow, that's kind of cool. Kind of as if we've seen it for the first time. So it's kind of in that spirit that I'm reading some of it. And also, I really recommend this book. It's a really, really valuable book for practicing with your life. The first quote from Ezra is, grasping after happiness doesn't bring happiness. It only perpetuates the grasping mind. And this is points also to one piece of the ignorance, which is that we think that it's going to somehow be different this time. Another quote from Lama Zopa Rinpoche, which is actually the quote on the April Fool's page of Daily Wisdom, which is a kind of calendar style collection of excerpts. It says, you follow desire and you are not satisfied. Again, you follow desire and again, you are not satisfied. Again, you try and again, you are not satisfied. Desire is the grasping after anything really never brings satisfying happiness. One place that I really saw this clearly, and this was a place where this is an example of me being unable to alter my behaviors, and I saw myself doing this. I saw going down this path, you know, kind of like the oncoming train coming at me in the tunnel. And so the other night, I had this huge craving for mashed potatoes, and I said to my girlfriend, I need some mashed potatoes. And right there, that was the first little little warning light going off, because anytime you construct with something I need, when you make your desires into needs, when you make your preferences into requirements, that's a sure recipe for suffering. And so I said, I need some mashed potatoes. I didn't really need mashed potatoes, but that's what I said. And so she was like, okay, well, let's go get you some mashed potatoes. It happened to be like, 10:30 or something in Inman Square, Cambridge. And there's a number of restaurants in that general vicinity that serve mashed potatoes. We went to one. One of them was closed. The other one was out of them. The next one we went to, we sat down and it was kind of busy. There seemed to be only one waitress on duty, and we sat there for like 10 minutes. And meanwhile, my kind of graspiness had kind of stepped up. My agitation had started to be good. So we were being ignored for like 10 minutes. At which, you know, here I was having a lovely evening out on the town with my girlfriend, but I couldn't appreciate that. I couldn't appreciate the music, the clean, crisp air. But all I could focus on was that the waitress was ignoring me and I wasn't getting what I needed. And so I was like, okay, well, let's just go. And so we got up and we left. And I was like, oh, my God, see, this is the problem with grasping. And I said, all right, let's just go to the convenience store. I'll get some frozen something or other. And the first convenience store I went to, they didn't have any. The next one they had some, but they were they contained hydrogenated oils, which are exceptionally bad for you, and you shouldn't eat them ever. So I couldn't get them. And then after an hour of like walking around trying to pursue this need for mashed potatoes, I was so cranky, you know. And so it really kind of like for me because it was such a trivial example. This pattern was so clear, the way this pattern of grasping and wanting after them and not getting them, or even getting them is gonna, you know, you get it and then you just have another desire, and you know, immediately right away you forget to, you lose track amid all of your graspiness, your desires, to be able to just relax into this moment, any moment, these mashed potatoes, this absence of mashed potatoes, and be able to appreciate that just as it is. One of the things that I want to present about greed, anger, and ignorance, I want to present these. I want to say that these are verbs rather than nouns. These are things we do. So karma, when we atone for the evil karma, the karma of greed, anger, and ignorance, karma, that word means action. And it's both action and the effects of the action, which themselves become causes for new action. So so when we're talking about the karma of greed, anger, and ignorance, I think it makes more sense to, this is why I frequently say grasping for greed. And I want to propose angering, or maybe angerizing, just to drive it home, which is, and this is, I'm going to come back to more when I get to anger, but it's the it was so clear to me today when I was at the mall, and I'm not going to go there yet. You're going to hear about it soon. So for ignorance, on the one hand, the word ignoring works very well as a indicator of what some of ignorance is. But it doesn't quite capture all of it, so I'm going to also throw out a couple of other options. One of them is selfing as a verb, and or ignorizing. my experience with these mashed potatoes and my failure to get these mashed potatoes also, as I was out walking around following this need, I reflected on this quote, which is from Rabina Khotan, who is a Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhist nun in the tradition of Lama Zopa and Lama Geshe, who I'm going to read a couple of other quotes from. She says, and this is a really vivid image, "Attachment is a honey-covered razor blade. We are convinced it's the prelude to pleasure, but in fact it leads to nothing but pain." I want to talk about this word attachment. So in Buddhism, you sometimes hear two other words. One is detachment. And a lot of the time in Buddhism, anytime you say the word detachment, somebody's going to correct you. No, it's not detached, because detached is some act of holding yourself away. It's kind of, it sounds like it's a practice of non-engagement with the world, of a practice of just sitting in, you know, silence as, you know, the world burns in front of you, or, you know, people suffer, or whatever. And so detachment is sometimes used for this, but it's usually corrected to non-attachment, which is not a positive state, but it's simply not being as fused onto something. But the word that I want to propose as one of the best for thinking about this is Pema Chodron's word for it, and it's hooked. So it's when you get hooked by your desires that suffering follows. So it isn't whether or not you have desires or don't have desires, because we're always going to have desires. It's how you relate when they arise. You know, they come on, they grab your mind and not let you go. That's getting hooked. And so the practice is another set of words for opening the hand of thought, which is the core practice of Zazen, especially Shikantaza, as we practice it, or just sitting, is unhooking ourselves from the thoughts that arise, from the desires that arise. And it isn't just desires and grasping that we can get hooked by. We can also get hooked by our aversion and our anger and our self and our ignorance, too. So, now,
let me talk a little about
anger, aversion, and angering. My computer at work completely died after a kind of a long, slow descent of becoming increasingly unreliable. This is the fourth computer by this particular company who I've bought, and I have never not had a problem with my hardware. And finally it died, and then I spent an hour on the the phone with customer service, and then finally I had to take it to the mall to drop it off to have it examined and purportedly fixed. You know, first I had to wait in line. I had to wait in line 20 minutes to get the beeper so that I could then wander around the mall waiting to be beeped. And then once I was beeped, after they said an hour, it was in fact 2 hours, then I would come and stand back at the desk and be ignored for 15 minutes while they went about doing whatever they were doing before they beeped me. And then they would finally open it up, and then after really around a minute, look at it and say, yeah, that's broken. So I was during the middle of this, when I was reflecting on all of my trauma and oh poor me and all of this, I could really feel like there's a narrowing that anger creates. There's kind of a darkening of the world. And then one of the images that we persistently use to talk about Zazen is space and spaciousness. And there's really like it's a claustrophobic sense. And eventually, you know, all that happens is you see your kind of dark, spinning, you know, revolving anger thing. And, you know, kind of doing that. This is angering, angerizing. It's cultivating that anger. It was really unpleasant. And I'm going to read a small extract here from Saying Yes to Life about anger. Do you imagine anger should be suppressed? Pushing anger down below awareness does not free us from its grip. When we do this, anger festers and its consequences continue unabated. Whether anger resurfaces as physical symptoms, depression, passive aggression, or explosive rage, sooner or later it will arise. Yet expressing anger in words and action is no more, or thoughts, I'll add, is no more skillful than pushing it down. And when we justify our anger, we get hijacked into believing that our thoughts are the truth. Without justifying anger, repressing it, or acting on it, we have only to genuinely feel our anger. When we do, we see the present moment of anger is very quiet and also very specific. Anger is never just anger, which is a mental concept. Rather, it is a concrete, visceral experience, perhaps of tightness, pulsing heat, pressure, or darkening and narrowing, plus strongly believed thoughts. My God, I've been so wronged! Bringing attention to these sensations in the quiet light of awareness, you may experience a release from the constricting belief that this emotion is you. So there at the mall, I decided, I was just really caught in my anger in this spinning dark ball, and I thought, you know, I talk about greed, anger, and ignorance all the time. I'm going to try out some of that Zen practice thing that I've heard about. That concretely was just looking at, what is this? What is this right now? And when this can be a touchstone of practice, this question, what is this? At any moment, we can ask ourselves this. We can use it as a koan, coming back to it over and over again. But even though I use that word as a koan, it's not that it's any kind of mystical special thing. It's not that the answer is going to be some answer of cosmic significance. It's really just a close, curious, precise examination of what are the thoughts that are going through here. What am I really hooked on believing right now? What is this experience right now? What is this going on in my visceral sense? And then when you start to see that, you can see the inherent neutrality of all of these things. So when we're hooked onto our anger, hooked onto our aversion, we think that the aversion itself is bad, the anger itself is bad. the thoughts itself, and that this situation that we're angry about is the true thing that's the problem. This situation is a bad unto itself. But when we start to unhook a little bit and we see, oh, it's that thought that I've been wrong. It's this thought that I have so many better things that I could be doing right now. It's this, you know, pulsing in my ears. Then we can see each of those in its component parts, and we can kind of spaciously welcome that in. And that, right then, that opens up the space back around this thing. So maybe there's this dark spinning ball still there, but it's spinning amid this kind of receptive open space of awareness that also includes a way of being calmly, equanimously, and comfortably present with all of these things. And so the anger might still be there, but we're no longer engaged in the process of angering. We're not this process anymore. And then when we start to do that, that also has the side effect of dissipating much of this anger. That's a side effect, though. We don't need it to dissipate that. That's only just a happen to be, what a lovely bonus for practicing Zen, that it actually does cause the anger to go away. But we don't need it to go away, because even when it's right here, we can practice with it. We can practice opening the hand of thought, experiencing it in its precision and spacious awareness, in its concrete visceralness. And I want to read another one of these. What separates us from living open-heartedly? What shuts life out? What cuts off our natural ability to truly love? As much as anything, the answer is this: our anger. Though our anger hurts both ourselves and others, we still cling to it. When our expectations or desires aren't met, anger insists, "No, I won't accept this." Yet even as we feel the pain that comes from rejecting things that can't be changed, we continue to indulge in anger's aversion with a stubbornness that defies all sense. So one of the other ways that I practice with anger, and just kind of negative reactivity in general, is, and especially, for instance, in the context of relationships, is I see these things arise for me, and I see myself having these reactions, and sometimes I'm able to be flexible and get out of it, but sometimes I'm not. But I am, even when I'm kind of stuck in a reaction, I'm sometimes able to say, you know, I'm having this reaction, and I can't get a whole lot of space from it, but I don't want to stand behind it. I don't want to claim that I'm right. I'm right now having this thing going on, this thing thinking how right I am. But you know what? I'm not asserting that thought about being right is itself the truth. And for me, I call that standing behind a reaction. And there's a big difference, and there's a much more spacious and generous and open difference in setting a bar for yourself as someone who never has anger, who never has to experience these things because they're bad, and someone who has anger and then goes, yeah, but I'm not standing behind that. And the way we word the precept of anger is acting from anger, not acting from anger, not indulging in anger. There's a way in which it really is an indulgence. So this doesn't mean we should suppress it, as this book just said. But and it depends. If there's a difference, like not acting angrily can. there's a place where we can be assertive. We can have anger and our needs arising and act assertively, but even with that, not stand behind the kind of the emotional force behind it, and just kind of in a spacious, neutral, flexible fashion express our needs, express our desire that some interaction go differently, being careful to see that we don't get hooked into believing that we need it to go that way. So this practice of observing precisely what is this? This is none other than opening the hand of thought, none other than just sitting, shikantaza. This is what we practice on the cushion. And shikantaza is very, very good for helping us see more and more clearly and have more and more space around our grasping and aversion coming up. And the part of the reason we emphasize the posture in this practice of just sitting is because each time we return to our body, to our breath, to our posture, that's a way of practicing being really concretely and densely present to what is. We're using the posture as an easy object to return to, and to really experience in its fullness, so that then when we're in the more difficult situation of having angry thoughts just bubbling over and stuff, we can use that very same skill and return to the thusness, the precisely thisness of those things, and see them just as they are without believing our stories and getting hooked by them. And there's a variety of different kinds of aversion. It can be aversion to ourselves, self-hatred, or a convincing story about our own inadequacy. And this obviously can cause us also a lot of suffering. Fear. Fear is actually, it's an aversion to the future. That's one kind of fear. It's about this thing that's going to happen. And it's this thing, so we create this idea that's the future, and then we have this story we tell ourselves about how much we hate this idea. And so there's a whole bunch of places that we can intervene in that kind of chain of events to be free from our suffering in that moment. One is we cannot tell ourselves stories about the future. Or if we do tell ourselves stories about the future, we can see them as just stories. And then if we tell ourselves stories about the future and we don't see them as just stories, we can maybe see it as the arising of a thought. Or if we miss that and then we start to get hooked by it, then we can practice unhooking. Or when we start to get afraid about this thing, we can see that fear, or we can recognize that it's fear about this imagined thing, and then or we can return to just this thing right here, this moment, this body and mind is never going to fail you as a refuge from fear of that kind. And then there's also aversion to the present, which we might feel, for instance, amid physical pain or psychological pain, which is right here, such as depression, those kinds of pain. But even those, and I'm speaking really honestly from my experience, even those are neutral. Even those experiences of really great physical pain, really great emotional pain, are themselves precisely neutral. They're not inherently bad, and there's a way to receive them and hold them too, in a way that lets you take refuge in the equanimity of this moment, this body and mind, this experience, just as it is. Experiences are like food. They can either nourish you or disrupt your being. Consider anger. When we really pay attention, the arising of anger may feel like a toxin, as if our bodies have ingested something that is making us physically sick. On the other hand, think of something you find calming, like walking in nature or sitting quietly by the ocean. Notice how mind and body usually settle down, as if our being is being nourished by these simple, wholesome experiences. But we can't just walk away from life and leave all the disrupting, unhelpful experiences behind. Instead, we must learn to digest our experiences in a new way. If you welcome a distressing event as an opportunity to awaken, it becomes nourishment instead of poison. And this is what Tori Zenji advises us to do here. Even if someone turns against us, speaking ill of us and treating us bitterly, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. And my favorite part of that is that it's best to bow down. You don't have to bow down. You can continue to be hooked. You can continue to tell yourself those stories. You can be absolutely certain, which is a manifestation of ignorance, that physical pain is bad. Or you can start to entertain, maybe not. You can use that. You can let that moment, the very arising of aversion, of pain, of anger, of fear, of pointing to a place where you are hooked. It's really pointing very exactly to the thing that's hooking you right now. And then when you combine that with the practice of what is this, and the practice of returning to just all of this, then you can start to be free from those things. Ignorance. And regarding the not standing behind the things that arise from you. There's also this quote from Ezra. The seemingly solid I is really many me's, and what's more, they often disagree. And this is the same thing that Walt Whitman expressed poetically as, I am vast, I contain multitudes. And so one of the things that we can see, really without a whole lot of really precise introspection, is that, you know, there's often contrasting poles. We're often ambivalent about a whole range of things. We kind of want that, we kind of don't want that, we kind of like this, we kind of hate it. You know, we love people, we hate people. And, or I'm having this angry reaction, but at the same time, I know it's really fundamentally kind of okay. So there's two reactions that are going on. And so the beginning of seeing that even in this moment, the thing that you're so sure of isn't completely true. There's other dissenting voices in your head. And that's freeing, because once there are two voices in your head and they're disagreeing, neither one of them can define the whole of your being, because you have to be, because you've got them both. And so this leads us into ignorance, ignoring, or surings, being certain. So ignoring, on the one hand, can be a form of turning away, and is related to aversion. But when we read the precepts and we use a version adopted from the Zen Peacemaker's Order, and we say we take refuge in the Dharma, giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, that is becoming unhooked from our ignorance. Anytime we're certainty, absolute certainty is a, you know, it's another neon pointer that there's something that's hooking you. It's a story about yourself or something that's hooking you. So while Shikantaza just sitting is a excellent antidote to grasping an aversion, the practice that helps us cut through, that is specifically designed to cut through these kinds of certainties, these kind of fixed ideas about who we are, about how things are, is koan practice. And this is what the practice of koans is designed to do. They're like kind of little specially shaped charges that detonate one idea after another about what Zen practice is, about what enlightenment is, about what a teacher should be, about what this moment should be, about what the Buddha is, about what the Dharma is. Mu, the first koan we work with in this school, is particularly good at this. And this is often not a pleasant experience to go through, this experience of having these things kind of detonate around you. But you can kind of start to feel lighter and freer around it, though. And the one way that working, that we can, one of the ways that James and his teacher John Tarrant suggests working with Mu is working with its English translation, which is no. Whatever thought comes up, responds with no. But this can kind of slide into negativism. So I actually wouldn't recommend that practice. I think a little more gentle is maybe not. You know, I really need some mashed potatoes. Maybe not. You know, I really hate having to spend all of my time doing this thing. I feel so wrong. You know, they just make such garbage. Maybe not. I'm someone who really needs... Maybe not. So, regarding certainty... I want to read a quote from Mark Twain, which I actually cribbed from the movie An Inconvenient Truth, which everyone should see. Mark Twain says, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." And this category of things we know for sure that isn't true is way huger than we might immediately imagine. In fact, this category of things we know for sure that just ain't so includes pretty much everything. And really engaging this practice of not knowing. This is Bodhidharma's practice of not knowing. This is the not knowing that is the highest practice of the Zen school. So ignorance can have a couple of different aspects aside from certainty. It's traditionally given as belief in a fixed self, belief in a permanent, abiding, unchanging self, which isn't even a big, that this is not a big philosophical deal. This no self is just the reality of there are many me's. there are many thoughts in our head that have stories about the way things are. And none of these thoughts, all of these thoughts, we can, with each one of them, open the hand of thought, return to that spacious awareness, and see that there's more than that, and that this can come or go or change, and none of that is us. So, and then not understanding karma is another kind of ignorance, or not believing in karma, which is just simply that what you do matters, that the way you use your mind creates suffering, or creates liberation. That's the fundamental truth of karma. The not understanding, not believing in, or I don't want to say believing in, but not seeing the reality of interdependence, of the way we really can't ever separate ourselves entirely from everything else. This came up kind of vividly for me in watching An Inconvenient Truth, in which, you know, one of the climatic changes is as a result of carbon emissions, of which the United States is, of course, egregiously guilty of, is that the water tends to concentrate in some areas and evaporate more quickly from the other areas, such as the sub-Saharan region of northern Africa. And so there's all of this strife in, for instance, Darfur. You know, there's all of this ethnic cleansing going on, and in part that it's fueled by intergroup tensions and shortages of supplies and of such basic life needs such as water. And the reason that the water is short is because the climate is changing, and the reason the climate is changing is because we do things like hop in our car to go half a block down the street to Walgreens or something. And so, like, this isn't about being, you know, feeling perpetually guilty at all. It's just the reality that acting anywhere is acting everywhere, and what we do matters. So certainty about ourselves, another kind of ignorance, or the kind of delusion that comes of believing that this time when I pursue desire, it's really going to work out for me, and I'm going to be happy and live happily ever after. Of course, for the previous 35 years, that hasn't really been true, but I'm really sure that this one thing, that mashed potatoes tonight, this is the one that's going to really do it for me. You know, or, you know, some less trivial example, but, you know, like money or a partner or a job or something like that. But even that. And this, these practices of opening the hand of thought, these practices of koan study, of practicing with mu, of practicing with maybe not, of practicing with what is this, all of these are immensely liberative practices. And like everything else in the world, they will let you down. And this, you can be free with these practices even as they're letting you down. There's that. And I want to just read a little bit about that. The honeymoon stage of any spiritual practice in the honeymoon stage of any spiritual practice, everything seems so fresh and mysterious. But as the lustrous sheen of novelty wears thin, as disappointments accrue, as old illusions are uncovered, practice will predictably and inevitably seem to become dry. The discouraging conclusions we draw in this dry place may seem like underlying truths, but they are just new illusions arising from an ever-changing and natural process. Becoming literally disillusioned, disabused of our own illusory notions, is always a good thing, a sure sign that your spiritual practice is proceeding apace. Disillusionment with practice is not a problem. The problem arises when we replace one illusion with another. May you all become disillusioned with practice, and may you all practice your lives diligently, every piece of it, not just by clocking more time on the cushion, not just occasionally, not just when it's easy, but really in every blessed moment of crappiness. And I just want to conclude with one more brief thing. We cling to our beliefs even when we know they cause suffering. We maintain our illusions even when they make us miserable. We know this, but we refuse to act on it. What are we waiting for? Thank you, everyone.